Ayatollah Khamenei says the U.S. intensified its Iranophobia and Shia phobia campaign only after Tehran frustrated all of its criminal schemes in other countries. Germany says its gas supply situation is tense and it can further deteriorate following Russia's decision to extend an outage of the Nord Stream 1 pipeline. Also ahead, Russia says the U.S. has refrained from issuing visas for its delegation to attend a U.N. General Assembly session later this month. Hello, welcome. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says one of the reasons behind the enmity of arrogant powers toward Iran is that it encourages other nations to stand up against bullying tactics. Ayatollah Sayyid Khamenei said the U.S. is at the helm of a system of global arrogance. He said neutralizing America's criminal plots in different countries, such as the defeat of Daesh, led to widespread Iranophobia and Shiaphobia campaigns, as well as accusations that Iran is interfering in other countries' affairs. The leader emphasized that Iran does not interfere in other countries' internal affairs, noting that they make such accusations because they have failed in preventing the progress of the Islamic establishment. Ayatollah Khamenei said that arrogant powers mean to draw unrealistic lines in the Islamic world. The leader added that the U.S. policy is to instigate conflicts between Shias and Sunnis, Arabs and non-Arabs, or even provoke infighting within Shia and Sunni communities. Ayatollah Khamenei was addressing the participants at the 7th Congress of the Ahl al-Bayt World Assembly in Tehran. Iran's Kish Airlines has resumed flights to Afghanistan. Iranian and Afghan officials say this paves the way for closer economic cooperation between Iran and conflict-stricken Afghanistan. Our correspondent has a report from Kabul.
Iran's Kish Airline is back to Afghanistan. Afghan and Iranian officials have welcomed this in a ceremony at Kabul's International Airport and stressed the importance of closer economic cooperation between the two countries.
We're happy today and welcome Turkish Airlines. We have very good relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran and do our best to expand cooperation in the political, economic and social fields.
This airway can be very helpful in the economic and cultural fields. I think such flights will soon be welcomed by other airlines as well, and that makes transportation between the two countries easier.
Iran has always tried to help boost Afghanistan's economy, and the resumption of Kish Air flights to Afghanistan can be considered another positive step in that regard.
Considering the changes that have taken place in Afghanistan since last year, the number of people coming from Afghanistan to Iran has risen, and that demand should be met. This is not enough, and we need to do more, and such activities are very effective in boosting economic relations between the two countries.
In recent months, Afghanistan has been deprived of many sources of international aid and even its own financial assets held in the United States. Now, Afghanistan's cooperation with Iran appears to be vital to the country's economic growth.
Such economic activities in cooperation with other neighboring countries promise the improvement of Afghanistan's economy by providing job and investment opportunities for people and for businessmen. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
Moving on to Yemen. Yemen's oil ministry has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a to shed light on the looting of Yemeni crude oil by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Says that Riyadh and its allies continue to block Yemeni fuel ships and steal the country's oil, despite a UN brokered truce. Abdul Latif al-Washali reports.
Yemen is facing a fuel crisis as Saudi Arabia and its allies continue to block fuel ships in violation of a UN brokered truce and steal the country's crude oil. Yemen's Ministry of Oil has held a press conference in Sana'a to discuss the issue.
There are 13 oil basins in Yemen, of which only two are invested, namely Safar and Al-Masila.
at a rate of only 18%. These basins are located in Marib and Shabwa, and they are controlled by the Saudi-backed forces. They are continuously being looted, and this reflects negatively on the Yemeni economy. The systematic looting is one of the reasons for the years-long war against us by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The ministry says the plundered oil is worth billions of dollars, which is enough to pay the suspended salaries of Yemeni employees. It held the Saudi-led coalition responsible for cutting off the salaries as the oil sales are being supplied to Saudi banks.
What the Saudi-led coalition is doing is the systematic looting of Yemeni oil and gas. The total amount that was looted from 2018 until July 2022 is about 130 million barrels, with a total value of about $9.5 billion. This money is enough to pay the Yemeni suspended salaries for 5 years. Unfortunately, they give the money from the plundered oil to the National Bank of Saudi Arabia and not the Central Bank of Yemen.
Yemen's petroleum company warned of an imminent fuel crisis as Riyadh is still preventing 9 fuel ships from entering the country, which is a clear violation of the UN brokered truce. However, the world body remains silent toward the Saudi violations.
As Yemenis face a fuel crash due to the Saudi blockade, they are urging the United Nations to force Riyadh to fulfill its commitments under the ceasefire agreement and to stop detaining fuel ships headed to the country. They say pillaging Yemeni oil also reveals why the Saudi-led coalition launched a war on their country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Germany bracing for further energy crunch as Russia extends the outage of gas supplies via the Nord Stream 1 pipeline. Germany's network regulator says the country's gas supply is guaranteed for now, but the situation is tense and could worsen. On Friday, Moscow said it scrapped a 72-hour deadline to resume flows via the pipeline, just hours before it was due to recommence deliveries. Moscow has cited a leakage of oil in one of the turbines for slashing the flow. Germany, however, says that the defects alleged by the Russian side are not a technical reason. In the meantime, the EU Economy Commissioner has noted that the bloc is ready for a full stop in gas deliveries from Russia. Paolo Gentiloni says the EU is well prepared to resist Russia's extreme use of the gas weapon. Moscow says the U.S. has so far refrained from issuing visas for the Russian delegation to attend a UN General Assembly session later this month. Russia's UN ambassador says none of the 56 Russian representatives have received entry visas to the U.S. as of Thursday. That includes Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who is set to lead the delegation to the 77th session of the UN General Assembly. In a letter to the UN Secretary General, Vasily Nebenzia called the move by the U.S. alarming. He said visa issuance in Washington's legal duty and not a right or a privilege. According to a 1947 agreement, the U.S. is not allowed to prevent representatives of member states from traveling to the UN headquarters in New York. The U.S. State Department spokesperson has blamed the delay on forced termination of local and third country national staff at the U.S. Embassy in Russia. One more incident of the U.S. police killing of an African American has sparked unrest, with hundreds hitting the streets to condemn the brutality and to demand justice for the victim. Protesters gathered in the city of Columbus, Ohio State, where 20-year-old Donovan Lewis was shot dead on his bed on Tuesday. Police were trying to serve a felony warrant when they showed up at his apartment. Soon after entering the house, the police opened fire, claiming the victim was holding something, but no weapons were found in the apartment. The Ohio Police Department says it is currently investigating the incident. Cities across the U.S. have been the scene of protests over police brutality and racial profiling against African Americans in recent years. A number of unarmed black men have been fatally shot at point-blank range or choked to death, mostly by white cops, over the past couple years. Italy's Football League Serie A says that it will put a 4-hour limit on the use of floodlights in stadiums on match days. It says that the measures aim to cut energy use as prices have gone up. That comes as the government in Rome is in talks to adopt energy-saving measures ahead of winter. Max Civelli has more.
On Thursday, Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a council of ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine.
Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, 3 times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that a price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
The G7 group has agreed to impose a price cap on Russian oil imports. Moscow says the move would lead to a shortage in global oil markets and rocketing prices for European consumers. Russia has also warned to retaliate by banning oil exports to countries imposing the restriction. The U.S. and Europe have been pushing for the move for months while facing soaring energy prices and inflation. So will this punitive measure against Russia prove to be effective? And most importantly, won't this destabilize the global economy even further?
The G7 countries have agreed to implement a price cap on Russian imports, despite warnings from the Kremlin to hold sales to countries imposing the restriction. Finance ministers of the United States, Japan, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, and the United Kingdom agreed on a plan to ban the provisions of services that enable maritime transportation of Russian-origin crude oil and petroleum products globally. This means importers seeking shipping services and insurance cover from companies based in G7 and EU countries would need to adhere to a price cap to transport Russian oil. The level of the cap is still being discussed. The German finance minister has stated the purpose of the move as such.
We want to limit Russia's revenues and at the same time reduce economic damage to our societies. This price cap on Russian oil exports is designed to reduce Putin's revenues.
The cap is expected to take effect at the same time as the next EU embargoes on Russian oil in early December. Moscow has warned that it will retaliate by banning oil exports to countries that implement the restriction. The Kremlin has warned that a price ceiling will significantly destabilize the oil markets, resulting in scarcity in global oil markets and soaring prices for European consumers. The ban is part of a range of measures taken by the West targeting Russia for the war in Ukraine. In response to the war, the U.S. decided to prohibit the import of oil, refined petroleum products, natural gas, and coal from Russia. These restrictions on Russian energy imports have contributed to higher gas prices and increased inflation pressure across the U.S. Washington's European allies are in no better condition. The European countries have plunged into a devastating energy crisis. Consumers are facing huge bills and the highest rates of inflation since the 1980s. Shell's chief executive officer has earlier warned that gas shortages could persist for several years, raising the prospect of continued energy rationing.
Well, in terms of the way that this has happened, the relationship between the West and Russia, first of all, has gotten worse. But the G7 is trying to stop the export of Russian oil purchased above a certain price. Well, for that to work, the group needs to get non-member states involved. In the meantime, Moscow has countered the EU and U.S. sanctions to limit its oil sales by boosting exports to countries like India and China. Moscow has also shut off the EU's Nord Stream gas supply. How far will this war over energy continue?
Russian energy giant Gazprom has halted flows via the crucial Nord Stream 1 pipeline to Europe. The company cited an oil leak and didn't give a timeline of when the shipments might resume. This comes in the wake of the G7 countries' decision to impose a price cap on Russian oil. The continued shutdown of the pipeline could exacerbate the energy crisis in Europe, as it is the biggest pipeline for gas from Russia, accounting for about 35% of Europe's total Russian gas imports last year. Russia had already threatened to retaliate by banning oil exports to countries that implement a price cap. Since June, Gazprom has slashed flows through Nord Stream 1 to just 20% of its capacity, citing maintenance issues as a dispute over a missing turbine caught up in Western export sanctions. It has also cut off supplies to several unfriendly European countries and energy companies over their refusal to pay for gas in rubles. The West has already sanctioned many Russian energy exports, but Moscow has continued to earn billions of dollars a month by diverting oil to countries such as China and India. China's crude imports from Russia soared to a record level in May, ousting Saudi Arabia as the country's top supplier.
The prices that are being paid for Russian oil are far higher than the cost of actually extracting that oil. So what the Russians are taking advantage, in other words, of the situation they're imposing by their boycotts and by the war in Ukraine.
The West is trying to sever the Kremlin's revenues by imposing a ceiling for Russian exports. But Moscow has proved that it can reduce the exporting of its products to Europe and still have mass revenues.
Russians are paying their last homage to deceased Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev before laying him to rest in Moscow later today. Gorbachev, known in the West as Gorby, died on Tuesday at the age of 91, following a long illness. A long line is formed as people march past the coffin. The funeral will be a low-key affair, as a few foreign leaders are expected due to the ongoing tensions between the West and Russia. Kremlin spokesman has said that there would be elements of a state funeral, such as a guard of honor and other formalities. Gorbachev was in power between 1985 and 1991. His tenure triggered the disintegration of the Soviet Union. In the West, Gorbachev is viewed as the man who ended the Cold War, but Russians have divided opinions about his foreign and domestic policies. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
National Day of Combating British Colonialism. Of September 1915 is the martyrdom anniversary of Iran's national hero, Rais Ali Delvari, the leader of the popular anti-colonialist movement in southern Iran, who spearheaded Iran's resistance to British colonialism and imperialism. In this program, we shall discuss the life and times of Iran's national hero, Rais Ali Delvari. Please stay with us. Rais Ali Delvari was born in 1882. He was an independent, freedom-loving individual who despised Britain's military incursions into Iran, Britain's occupation and colonialist activities in southern Iran, and he led and organized a popular movement to oppose British colonialism in Iran, centered in the southern port city of Bushehr, as well as the Tangestan region of southwestern Iran. In the early stages of the First World War, the Russian army invaded northern Iran and simultaneously British military forces invaded the south. British warships anchored in the southern Iranian port city of Bushehr unleashed an occupation army in the port city, hoping to occupy the port city and the surrounding areas. But the angry local population of Bushehr put up a fierce resistance, much to the surprise of the British. Britain considered southern Iran as its own territory ever since the unfair and one-sided oil contract of 1907 was signed by Iran and Britain. In 1915, in the middle of the First World War, the British decided to invade southern Iran. Their objective was threefold: to stop their rivals, particularly Germany, from gaining a foothold in Iran, to control the waters of the Persian Gulf, and to suppress the local tribes who inhabit southern Iran. Using the pretext that the German consulate in the port city of Bushehr in southwestern Iran was stoking anti-British sentiments among the local population in Tangestan region, the British launched their military occupation of southern Iran in March of 1915. Not surprisingly, Britain's invasion and occupation angered the local population of southern Iran, resulting in widespread anti-British sentiments. Organized resistance to British occupation was led by a 33-year-old local man named Rais Ali Delvari. The resistance scored some significant victories in the fight against the British, targeting both the interests of Britain and British servicemen in the port city of Bushehr. The British, meanwhile, responded by attacking local villages near Bushehr, killing a number of locals and burning their belongings and possessions. A local religious leader in Bushehr, Ayatollah Sayyid Abdullah Baladi, disgusted by the savage and unethical behaviour of British military personnel, joined the fight against the occupation and established close contact and liaison with popular resistance leader Rais Ali Delvari. Ayatollah Sayyid Abdullah Baladi declared a jihad against the British and also issued a fatwa or religious decree prohibiting the buying and selling of British-made goods and commodities. Ayatollah Baladi's house became the centre of resistance to British occupation, and he provided local hero Rais Ali Delvari with valuable assistance in his anti-British campaign. On one famous occasion, the Tangestan resistance forces, under the leadership of Delvari, managed to kill 2 senior British military commanders, as well as 11 Indian soldiers who worked for the British. This valuable victory shattered the image of the British military in the mind of Iranians, reducing the fear that the Iranian population felt. This victory meant a lot for the resistance movement in southern Iran. Sadly, Rais Ali Delvari was martyred on 3rd of September 1915 in the port city of Bushehr during a fight with British occupation forces. He was 33 years old at the time and very quickly became a symbol of resistance to foreign occupation and colonialism. The people of Iran regard Rais Ali Delvari as a national hero, a great soldier who led the anti-colonial, anti-imperial resistance movement of southern Iran. In order to commemorate and honour the courage and the valour of Rais Ali Delvari and the people of southern Iran against the old colonial enemy, Britain, 3rd of September has been designated as the National Day of Combating British Colonialism in the Iranian calendar. The history of British presence in Iran goes back to the Safavid period. Even though Britain lacked an effective navy to compete with the Portuguese navy at that time, the British nonetheless found other ways to infiltrate Iran. For the British, Iran was a country with very rich and plentiful natural resources and was located in a very strategic geographical position in West Asia. Another famous British-American plot and conspiracy which has been etched in the collective memory of the Iranian people is the August 1953 coup d'etat, which brought down the popular nationalist government of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. The British, with the help of the Americans, particularly America's Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, organized a coup d'etat against the government of Mohammad Mossadegh. The British hoped to once again plunder Iran's rich oil reserves. Through this coup d'etat, and a dark period of 25 years followed in Iranian history, which ended with the glorious victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution in February of 1979. The
first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is the member you are listening to. May Allah accept your mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Today we invite you to listen to an English lecture by Brother Amin Rastani.
These next nights, inshallah, I want to discuss different topics in regards to the aza of Imam Hussein, the remembrance of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. This blessing that we have, that if we're not careful, we might take for granted. If that day of the year that we're looking forward to as the azadar of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is the first of Muharram, and this new year for us begins, by the way, Muharram is the first of the months of the lunar calendar anyway, right? So if I'm going to be looking at it as the beginning of my year, as the azadar of Imam Hussein, what does an azadar of Imam Hussein look like once this new year has passed? The first day of the new year has passed. Now, the first day of the new year for us, if Muharram is going to be that beginning for us, is 2 months and 8 days or so. So it's not just one day either. So right here we find that we have a lot of motivation. It's not just one day. People, when they make a decision to, you know, lose weight on the first day of January, right? They usually forget by the 7th, 8th, 10th of January, right? Am I right? The motivation dies out. Because, I mean, especially those first days that are off, you're going places, there's food, there's desserts and all that kind of stuff. I mean, who starts their diet on such a day? Start it like on March or something like, you know what I'm saying? Don't do it on Thanksgiving. Don't do it on the first of the new year and so on. So for us, we're blessed that our new year is 2 months of motivation. Imam Hussein alayhi salam has conquered the hearts. Who is there to deny this? So I want to talk about a little bit about what the Azadar is supposed to look like after this new year passes, after things go back to normal, inshallah, because we are getting closer, and before you know it, it will be the end of this Muharram and Safar season. What does an Azadar of Imam Hussein, inshallah, look like after the new year is over? This new year of 2 months and 8 days. This new year of connection after connection after connection. Every tier is a connection to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. This person, what I very humbly believe they should look like, inshallah, after Muharram and Safar have passed and things go back to normal, that motivation slowly diminishes. Yes? And we go back to our normal lives. There are a few things I've listed here. Number one, that the Azadar of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is going to be a hard worker. You know why? Because Hazrat Abbas for 35 years, they say, was preparing. Preparing for what? For a day that he won't be able to do what he wants to do anyway. It doesn't matter. 35 years he's lived in this life. And they say, he doesn't really receive anyone too well in Medina. He knows what these people did to Fatima Zahra. But he's getting ready for a day that he was made for. But Hazrat Abbas, you don't know. You're not going to be able to get it done the way you wanted to. Who cares? I work hard. I'm not going to waste my time. A hard worker, reliable. That's what an Azadar of Imam Hussein is. And so here, this is where we need to grow up a little bit. Once we're getting older, if we have connected with Imam Hussein throughout our lives, once I'm a little bit older, I have to have this. I have to be trustworthy. I have to be reliable. Hazrat Abbas teaches me this. That if there's no one out there, oh Hussein, that will not question anything you say, it's going to be me. Oh Allah, I'm an Azadar of Imam Hussein, so I will never question anything you have that you want me to do as a proper Muslim and follower of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Number two, brothers and sisters, now this is not something that you will actively do. It has to happen naturally, and that is that everyone is in love with the proper Azadar of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. You know why? Because inside this individual is a fire that's burning, and so others aren't going to be burnt by this person. The fire of Imam Hussein is supposed to eat away at me from the inside, not allow me, give me the opportunity to hurt anybody anymore. I don't know what some of us are doing, brothers and sisters. I don't know. That for the purpose of Imam Hussein, we're going to hurt some people. We have to be very careful about this. Inshallah, this is not something that's happening. We have to be very careful. The real Azadar of Imam Hussein, everyone loves them. Why? Because for them, they always feel safe when it comes to this person. The Imams have told us, this individual, a proper mu'min, is who? Badanuhu fi ta'ab wa nasu minhu fi raha. This person, they themselves, their body is tired and in fatigue because they work so hard. Hazrat Abbas, is there any time that he was comfortable? But the people, he's such a hard worker, or she's such a hard worker. But the people, though, they're in comfort when it comes to this person. Why? Because they don't have to worry. Oh my God, I slipped up in front of this person. This happened, that happened. Now I got to watch out because people are going to be messaging each other, spreading things. No. Proper Azadar of Imam Hussein, after this quote-unquote new year is over, yes, they go back. We all go back to our normal lives. That's where Allah is actually watching. because the hype is slowly dying out. We have to go back to normal again until next year. That's when I have to watch out for myself. It's easier said than done. It's easier for me to sit up here and talk about it, but for me to walk the walk, it will take sacrifice. Another thing about the Azadar of Imam Hussein, inshallah, is that Imam Hussein, did you know, was in love with somebody himself? The one that everyone is in love with. Imam Hussein was in love with somebody out there. His name was Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so, who is this that Imam Hussein is so in love with? Because I thought that's where it ends right there. Imam Hussein is where it ends, of love. But then there's somebody that Imam Hussein is doing everything for and giving everything for, and he's just talking to him all the time on Ashura. Are you happy now? Are you happy now, O Allah? Do I need to give my Asghar? Do I need to give Abdullah bin al-Hasan, that last orphan after Ali and al-Asghar, that final test of Imam Hussein? Allah, who is this? Who is this Allah? So for me, very personally, if it was me, what I would say is that I will count how many majalis I've been to in Muharram and Safar, and I will make sure that I will spend that much time throughout the other 10 months. 10 months is 5 times 2 months, right? I will try my best to at least spend that much to learn about who this person is, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that Imam Hussein is so in love with. Trust me, there is more to say about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala than anything else. Anyone else? He has spoken to us. 600 plus pages of the Quran is a manifestation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Imam Hussein says on the night of Ashura, إِنِّي أُحِبُّ تِلَاوَةَ كِتَابِ اللَّهِ, I love to recite the Quran. لَهُمْ دَوِيٌّ كَدَوِيٍّ النَّحْلِ, you could hear a humming sound on the night of Ashura. They are reciting Quran. You just hear the humming sound though. Isn't that beautiful? So this Azadar of Imam Hussein, inshallah, is going to be seeking something here. I've gotten a taste of divine love through Imam Hussein. Let me complete this now with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But the thing is, with Allah, it's a little more long term. With Allah, because the love is so great, it takes a lot of work. Yes, it's not for everybody maybe. It's not for everybody. It takes work day in and day out, watching out that I might, the wajibat, the muharramat, am I observing these? How much am I thinking about Allah? How much am I learning about Allah? How much am I reciting His book? How much ibadah am I doing, as much as the time allows me in my life? How much of it? These things build a person's iman to the point that they fall in love. Love with Allah is going to be the same genre of love with Imam Hussein, because they're both divine. But getting there is going to be a little bit harder. It's going to take work. But look, Imam Hussein is pushing us. Imam Hussein is behind us, saying, look, anytime you get stuck, just look back and look what I did. I sacrificed. I made sacrifices. You need to do that work. I taught you that in one day. Allah doesn't want that from you. What I went through in one day, spread it out over 70 years. And still we won't get even close to that sacrifice. But, you know, figuratively speaking here, and very loosely speaking, how much sacrifice do I have to make every day? If I spread out the sacrifice of Ashura, spread it out over 100 years. Yes? Something like that. We have to look at it like that. So it will take work.
Swear to Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call the back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Mark Tufnell, president of the Country Land and Business Association, which represents about 30,000 British landowners and rural businesses, said Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak, the two candidates for the leadership of the British Conservative Party, had done too little to show how they would boost the countryside economy and deal with pressing concerns such as planning, rural broadband and farm support. We have prepared for you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled British Rural Voters Ignored by Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Fiona Harvey's article. The head of the UK's biggest rural business organisation said neither of the candidates for leadership of the Conservative Party has made a convincing pitch to rural voters in Britain, despite that demographic being one of the biggest sources of Tory power. Mark Tufnell, president of the Country Land and Business Association, which represents about 30,000 landowners and rural businesses, said Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak had done too little to show how they would boost the countryside economy and deal with pressing concerns such as planning, rural broadband and farm support. Mark Tufnell said, "I don't think either candidate really understands what is happening in the countryside and what the real issues are." He added, "Both of them have said nice things about farms, but there is no understanding of what is actually happening in the countryside. They have not said much about it." Mark Tufnell warned that the failure could cost the party at the next general election. He said, "They assume that we in the countryside vote Conservative and that they don't really need to worry about us, but they should." At the 2019 election, 46% of voters in rural counties voted Conservative and only 29% voted Labour. But polling conducted by the Country Land and Business Association CLA before Boris Johnson's resignation found a sizeable swing of about 7.5% from the Tories to Labour, putting the two main parties neck and neck in some rural areas of Britain. The Liberal Democrats are also making inroads with strong local election showings and the capture of the formerly safe blue seat of Tiverton and Honiton in Devon in the June by-election. Mark Tufnell said, "The Tories have taken countryside voters for granted," adding, "they've shown a lack of interest." While Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak have sought to reassure farmers during their campaigns, Mark Tufnell pointed out that the bulk of countryside voters and businesses were not farmers. Farming accounts for only 4% of the rural economy and 7% of rural jobs are farming-related. About 85% of rural businesses are not related to farming or forestry. And while 12 million people of voting age live in rural areas of the United Kingdom, there are only about 100,000 farmers. For rural businesses outside farming, key issues include connectivity, since rural broadband and mobile phone access lags far behind that available in urban areas, and planning regulations, as many businesses chafe against some planning rules. The CLA, the Country Land and Business Association, has also said that a lack of affordable rural housing is stifling growth. Both Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak have promised to retain or tighten planning laws. Rishi Sunak promised no building on green belt land, and Liz Truss vowed to drop house building targets. Each would restrict the building of solar farms and onshore wind farms. Mark Tufnell is also concerned that the new Tory leader could bow to pressure from some on the right wing of the party and dismantle reforms to farm support payments, which are being gradually introduced. Unlike the European Union system of payment for the amount of land farmed, under environmental land management contracts or ELMs, farmers will be paid public money for providing public goods. In return for the subsidies, they will be asked to nurture soils, plant trees, improve water management, protect wildlife, and take other measures that help to clean the air and clean water and safeguard nature. The National Farmers Union, the NFU, has spoken out against the reforms, arguing that at a time of rising food prices, the focus should switch to supporting farmers to grow more food. Mark Tufnell, whose 28,000 members own about half the land in England and Wales, urged Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss to stay with existing policy and give farmers stability. Mark Tufnell, who owns and manages a mostly arable farm in the Cotswolds and is a Conservative Party member, said, "It's a false argument that you need to stop ELMs or environmental land management contracts to grow more food. You can do both. Without clean air and water and nurtured soils, you can't produce food anyway. And if you're taking money from the public purse, you should show a benefit to the public." Mark Tufnell said, "ELMs, or environmental land management contracts, are world-beating. They are very forward-thinking. They are the way the rest of the world will go eventually, but at a slower pace." Tufnell noted both candidates represented rural constituencies, Liz Truss in East Anglia and Rishi Sunak in Yorkshire, but he said their policy ideas had focused on towns and cities. He said, "The main focus still remains on the metropolitan and urban areas. There is a lack of focus on the countryside." Mark Tufnell said even the drought, which has scorched pastures and left crops dying in the fields to the despair of farmers across the Midlands and south and east of England in particular, had failed to elicit much response. He added, "I'm not sure how much notice either of them has taken of the drought. They have just been running round the country." Mark Tufnell called for the winner of the leadership election to install a proper rural champion at No. 10 Downing Street, who would advocate for policies reflecting the needs of rural Britain. The CLA, the Country Land and Business Association, has estimated that investing in the countryside to bring the key infrastructure in rural areas, such as housing, transport, communications and technology, into line with that in towns and cities, would improve the UK's economic productivity by £43 billion. Mark Tufnell said, "There is a lack of infrastructure that is holding the countryside back. There is enormous potential, but it needs political focus." Members of Britain's Conservative Party had until 5 p.m. on Friday, 9th of September, UK time, to choose their next leader and therefore decide who will succeed the outgoing Boris Johnson as the next Prime Minister. the cost of living crisis, what the government should do about it, and how that should be paid for, has dominated the hustings. Liz Truss launched her campaign with promises of big tax cuts and suggested her government could increase borrowing to pay for them. Her plan to tell people what they want to hear, see this week's ruling out of energy rationing, has left Rishi Sunak with no other choice than to stick to his orthodox stance that the country can't afford tax cuts given the pandemic and the war in Ukraine. Sunak hasn't been able to make his accusations of fantasy economics stick, nor has he benefited from reminding everyone that his rival was a Remainer. Liz Truss has made the Ukraine issue her own and has also profited from the press narrative that Boris Johnson was shafted by the Westminster elites, for whom, read Sunak.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on July 27, 2022.
The second point is to deal with everyone as though you are their father. All sorts of people attend your Friday prayers. Be kind to everyone. They are all your children. I understand that you might be more interested in the young revolutionary fighters. I don't blame you, and that's fine. But even if someone is not like that, they are still your sons. They are still your children. Even in his own home, a person might love one of his children more than the others, but this should not prevent him from being a father to his other children. You need to treat everyone as though you are their father and they are all your children. The Ghadir celebration in Tehran, in which over 3 million people attended in the form of a 10-kilometer-long celebration, was truly extraordinary. I don't know whether you saw it or not. I saw it on television myself and heard about it from some people who had attended. Did you see how all sorts of people took part in this celebration in the millions? These people are in favor of religion. They like religion. One time during one of my trips to one of the provinces, I had a meeting with the respected scholars of that province. I told them, as I was coming today or yesterday, there was a crowd surrounding the car I was in. They wanted to express their love, and some of them were even crying. Amongst them, there were individuals whom, if you had met them, you wouldn't have thought they even believed in religion. But that's the way it is. They do believe in religion. I have a lot to say on this topic, and I have talked about this in the past. Now isn't the time to talk more about it. So treat everyone in a fatherly manner and bring everyone to sit at the table of religion and spirituality. This is another point.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another matter is that the behavior of the Friday prayer leader should be people-oriented. He needs to be a people person. What do we mean by being a people person? It means that as one of the people, you need to go and be present amongst them, talk to them, and don't distance yourself from them. Don't just interact with the special privileged group. If necessary, go to people's homes every now and then, sit on their rugs and under the roofs of their houses, ask them how they are. Just being amongst the people is an important task in itself. Some people making inappropriate interpretations about the very valuable public visits of officials is wrong. In fact, these people have been misled. Going amongst the people, talking and listening to them is important.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.